Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. First called the People's Department by President Lincoln, the United States Department of Agriculture is a diverse and complex organization. From enhancing economic opportunities for agricultural producers, to protecting the nation's food supply, to improving nutrition and health, the USDA supports programs that touch the lives of all Americans every day. How does USDA assist rural communities? What does USDA do to promote the country's agricultural production and exports? What is the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, and how does it seek to promote access to safe and nutritious foods? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Welcome, Kathleen.
I am happy to be here.
Great. Before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you could provide us with a brief overview of the history and continuing evolution of USDA's mission.
Well, you sometimes see old engravings of the U.S. Capitol, and there are farm animals grazing in front of the U.S. Capitol. That's because all of that area where we now have the Smithsonian Museums that so many American families visit, that used to be all of USDA's research farm. And years later, after USDA began, we moved that out to Beltsville, Maryland. But USDA really is an old institution. It was created in 1862 by an act of Congress and signed into law by Abraham Lincoln, the president. And we refer to it as the People's Department. It's a wonderful place. It's a very big place. We have three big buildings right there on the Smithsonian Mall, but we also have offices around the country and around the world.
With such an expansive mission, would you give us a sense, and you kind of touched on it just now about its operational reach, what's the size of the number of FTEs in your organization, its footprint, and the budget?
Well, the budget is about $145 billion. What people don't realize is that nearly two-thirds of that budget is for nutrition assistance programs. So people think USDA, they think farmers, ranchers, but actually we do food stamps, which is a supplemental nutrition assistance program. We are involved in the school meals programs, the National School Lunch Program, for example. So really, the bulk of our money is going to nutrition assistance, but it's a large amount of money, $145 billion, at least now as we speak. Everyone knows there's a lot of budget cutting going on in D.C., mm-hmm. We also have a hard time saying exactly how many FTEs we are because there are different ways of counting. There are state employees that we essentially fully fund. And so do you count them? Do they not count? We are somewhere in the range of 114,000 FTEs. We are the fifth largest employer in the federal government.
So could you tell us a little bit about your specific role as the deputy secretary? What are your specific responsibilities and duties?
Well, it's not a short list. As deputies are, they are alter egos to their secretaries. So I am there to advise, first and foremost, Secretary Vilsack on everything that comes before the department. Specifically, I am in charge of the budget process, budget formulation, tracking where the money goes, which is increasingly taking up time in this environment. I have a particular role in this administration to lead efforts on building local and regional food systems. Because of my background coming in, my interest, Secretary Vilsack asked me to lead an initiative. President Obama, one of the few things he talked about in agriculture when he was on the campaign trail was the need to invest more in local regional food systems. And so I've had great pleasure working in that and also all the issues around childhood obesity, childhood hunger with the First Lady. So all of those issues are sort of my true loves.
So with that, and speaking of true loves, what are some of the challenges, maybe the top three challenges you face in your position, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
Well, time is not on our side, right? Coming in as a political appointee, I'm very cognizant of the sand running through the hourglass. I luckily had the experience of being an agency administrator the last couple of years of the Clinton administration. So, you know, I understood that you really have to set priorities. And so I guess that is a challenge, not only for me, but all senior executives with all the things that are pressing upon us. How do we really have laser focus and know how to manage our time to those priorities? I think it's a really challenging institution to manage, USDA, because of the breadth of what it does and the challenge of the disconnect of what Americans know about American agriculture, because less than 1% of Americans now have experience, direct experience being on the farm or the ranch. They don't really understand the broad mission of USDA. So we really have a sales job that we have to do both to the American people and to other policymakers here inside the Beltway.
I know you mentioned that you were an administrator under the last part of the Clinton administration. You also mentioned, at least you had experience on the Hill. I think you were instrumental in passing and authoring some legislation as well. Could you tell us a little bit more about your career path and how did you begin your career and what brought you to your current leadership role?
Well, I always knew I was interested in politics, so I started, my first job out of college was to run a state Senate race for a man who's now the congressman from the first congressional district in Massachusetts, John Olver. So I worked in state legislature for a few years, went and got a master's in public policy in Texas, worked for the State Department of Agriculture there. No, it wasn't Commissioner Perry at the time. It was Commissioner Hightower, but I do have some Texas roots for that reason and interest in the department, the history over the years. I worked in the Senate Agriculture Committee for 6 years for Pat Leahy, who is chair, and went back to school on the eve of a Clinton victory in a senior position in the Senate staff. I went back to do my PhD, and some people thought that was a crazy career move, but one of the things that I found personally very valuable is to go back and forth between academia and the day-to-day grind in the policymaking world, because I think that going back and forth has made me a better practitioner.
Well, actually, what kind of skills do you need to do that? That's an interesting point, juxtaposing the practitioner versus the academic. And I'm just wondering, do you see yourself having to accentuate certain skills that you don't need in one area that you do need in the other?
I actually think that I think both help you sharpen that same core skills that you need in terms of setting priorities, making very clear, cogent argument. I challenged all my students to take complex public policy issues and reduce them down to a 2-page memo, because that is what we trade in Washington, right? And if you get a memo, if you're lucky enough to get the president's attention on something, you're sending a memo into the Oval Office, you don't get 2 pages. It's less than that because of just the complexity of everything that he has to deal with. So really learning to research an issue. Very few things that we think about these days are new. There's so little that's new. And I really learned in academia that you really need to understand the origin of an idea, its evolution, understand, has this been tried before? How has it worked? So in some cases, maybe people think I'm a little pointy-headed for my current position, but ultimately, I think having that kind of instinct saves time and saves some costly mistakes.
I want to get a sense of the characteristics of an effective leader. Could you give us your sense of what those characteristics are, and how has it changed in an interconnected and networked world?
Well, it certainly has changed. I mean, I really learned that from my graduate students up at Tufts University, where I was at. I had the students who were the best and the brightest, you know, straight A, top scholars from their undergraduate institutions, really gung-ho students. They don't read newspapers. I mean, my husband and I, you hear the thump at the end of the driveway in the morning. We get the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. I mean, I live for that. All of my students read online. They got their news in different ways through social media, maybe those late night talk shows. It's just really, it opened my eyes and realized that if I was going to lead an institution that not just had people of my generation, but younger people too, I was going to have to think differently. So I think all of us are challenged, but it's great opportunities. In this time of constrained budgets, we're doing a lot more with bringing people in through teleconferences. We've set up a number of sites at headquarters at USDA, for example, where we reach out to all of our state directors on one phone call to talk about issues on a regular basis. So we really can save money by investing in some of the technology. It's working quite well. What are the real challenges of leadership? What makes a good leader? Well, that's a big question. There's certainly libraries full of books that give you all the answers, right? For me, it's really trying to empower people around you, around me, to speak truth to power. I think that when you get up at these high ozone level type of jobs, people are very hesitant to say, Kathleen, you're wrong, mm-hmm. or Kathleen, this isn't. There's another way to look at this. And so how do you engender a culture around you that people feel very comfortable bringing issues that are important and that may not sit well with you on first view? So I think that's really important leadership, a skill that I've really worked on and hopefully have succeeded in. I also think it's very important to empower people at various levels in the bureaucracy. We have this task force now we call Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. And it's not all the people with the big name jobs at USDA. I basically said to agency administrators, I want the people who want to be there. Mm-hmm. I don't care what their rank is, what their background is. I want enthusiasm. I want people who are ready to add this to their current workload, not as a burden, but as a joy. And really, it's been a lot of fun. So I don't know. There are a lot of different leadership techniques. Undergrad, how I got in politics is I was mentored by James McGregor Burns, who wrote a very well-known book on leadership, and that was the actual title of it. And he talks about transactional leadership, transformative leadership. I mean, there are all these different kinds of models and books to read, but really, right now, I'm very focused on the younger generation, bringing them into USDA, bringing them into American agriculture, and trying to build excitement for them to do so.
Well, interestingly, you mentioned James McGregor Burns, but who else has influenced you in, from a leadership perspective?
Well, I had Barbara Jordan as a professor. Oh, really? Her powerful voice on ethics reverberates in my head to this very day. That was she was a really great mentor. I had Ray Marshall as a professor, former Secretary of Labor, who taught me the power of the two-page memo. So he is a really, really important mentor. I certainly have had a lot of politicians who have been incredibly important in shaping my views. Patrick Leahy, he was really big on empowering staff. He still is. He's, of course, the second most senior senator in the Congress. He would like to say, senators are merely constitutional impediments to their staff. And we'd all joke, but what he would do is he wouldn't keep the staff shuttled in the background. He would bring me and my colleagues front and center and say, Kathleen did this, or Kathleen's the expert on this. And that didn't detract from his power. It didn't detract from his prestige as a senator, but he helped build a cadre of professionals that could go on and have careers based on their work in the Senate. I was really, really taken by his vision on that. John Oliver, the congressman in Western Mass, he taught me that he was a former physics professor, PhD, tough guy in terms of being really analytically 100%. And so he really taught me to cross my T's and dot my I's before stepping forward.
What is USDA doing to transform rural America and enhance its prosperity? We will ask Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at USDA, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.